This is the Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. Glad to have you along this morning. And glad to have in the studio with me Kara Cooney. She is an Egyptologist and the author of the new book, The Woman Who Would Be King, Hatshepsut's Rise to Power in Ancient Egypt. It's quite a tale. Welcome to the Book Club at 91.7, Kara.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask about your introduction to Hatshepsut.
My real introduction was very media-based because I was asked to be on a Discovery Channel television show back in 2006 all about Hatshepsut. And she's not somebody that I study in my own academic work. And so I studied hard and learned all about her for this television show and then forgot about her. And it wasn't until my literary agent approached me and said, you know, we really think a book about this woman would be nice. And I thought, but I don't work on that. That's not what I do academically, because academics, we live in these little tiny boxes and we think we can only talk about these things that we study and focus on. And I thought about it a little more and I realized that to write a biography from cradle to grave that was considering all of the aspects of her life, it's better that I don't work on any data from Hatshepsut's reign, because then I don't have an axe to grind. I don't have anything to prove academically. And so I can come at it kind of like a high-level journalist, if you will, and approach it that way and tell a more even and balanced story.
It seems at first glance that Hatshepsut is perfect for being a leader. She was a daughter of a king, sister of the king, wife of the king, but not mother of the king. And that's where she became very special, because she did get power despite the fact that she didn't bear an heir to the throne.
That was the twist of fate that changed everything, that set the foundation for her rule, because she only bore a daughter, Nefru-Re, who ended up being a very powerful woman in her own right. But you need to be male to be king, or so everyone thought at the beginning, because as Hatshepsut's path moved forward, as she's regent for this young child, along the way, something happened. We don't know what, if it was a smallpox epidemic that swept through the palace and freaked everybody out because they thought, oh, the prince could die at any moment, or if there was a political competition from parts of Egypt that we don't even know about. But for some reason, this woman decided to formalize her informal power and become crowned as king. You can't call her queen, because in ancient Egyptian, the word queen has no political connotations. It's just the wife of the king, the woman of the king, really. And so she became king in the formal sense and was crowned, according to her, by the god Amun-Re himself. We can only wonder how that must have happened.
Well, I wanted to ask, because it seemed that the political life in Egypt at the time of Hatshepsut was relatively calm. It wasn't, you hear about so many bloody battles and conflict going on and political machinations, and it seems that it was a little more above board and nice, for lack of a better word, in Hatshepsut's time. Is that right?
Egypt as a whole, as a geopolitical entity, as a geographic region, is very calm. And if you compare Egypt to other parts of the Middle East, to the Greek mainland, parts of the world where there's constant competition, and if one man is swept aside, there's always another man to take his place. Egypt, by contrast, was interested in continuity and stasis and continuance and status quo. And that's where the women come in. Egypt allowed more women in power in the ancient world than any other place, any other state, any other regional entity. And that's because the women could come in as stopgaps. They could come in as placeholders. So if there was a king that was too young or incapacitated, or it was the end of the dynasty and there was no one left, then they let the women into power. And Hatshepsut is one of them. But she's special because she takes that placeholder position, that informal position, and she formalizes it and she aggrandizes it and exploits it and makes it bigger and more fabulous than any other woman before or since.
I'm speaking with Kara Cooney. She's the author of The Woman Who Would Be King, Hatshepsut's Rise to Power in Ancient Egypt. You can learn more at our website, wvxu.org. Some interesting links there. I wanted to ask, how did she manipulate that? I mean, I know it's difficult to say exactly how she did it, but how did this Hatshepsut become the woman who could be king or would be king?
It's difficult to say directly, but if you look at the courtiers' tombs and you look at the way they talk about her, one of her chief means to gaining more and more power was by paying off the people, the elites who were doing the work for her. And just by looking at tombs, decorated tombs, which was a way for an ancient Egyptian elite to show his place in society and how important he was. If you look at the tombs from before Hatshepsut's reign, there's very few. They're big, but they're not fabulously decorated. Then you look at the courtiers' tombs during the reign of Hatshepsut, and all of a sudden there is this explosion in tomb building. It's telling us that people have money. People are being paid better than they were before. She's spreading the wealth in a way previous kings either didn't have to or didn't want to. She feels she needs to do this. So we see more wealth in the elite circles and more display of that wealth. So one of her chief means of getting that power was by making herself economically indispensable to those around her, if that makes sense.
Always a strong position.
Yeah, power and money are always inextricably connected.
I found it interesting. You mentioned that personal details about royalty in Egypt are difficult to find, and it seems like it was a very civilized society at the time. And it really struck me as I was reading the book how civilized it was, and I'm just shaking my head. Why? Why?
And let me put it this way, because if you're comparing it to ancient Rome, and a lot of us have seen the Rome HBO special, and you know everyone's trying to slander somebody, and they're creating these character attacks and talking about who's sleeping with whom, and writing it down and publishing this information about their competitors. Same with Greece, and same with the ancient Near East to a large extent. And assassinations are common in these parts of the world, but Egypt, by contrast, really celebrated its lack of slander, lack of personal attacks. And I guarantee you, people were talking about other people, but there was nothing to be gained in the Egyptian political system by writing it down and publishing these things. And regicide was something that happened so rarely. As far as we know, there's only two instances before the Ptolemaic period, which is pretty extraordinary.
Speaking with Kara Cooney, her book is The Woman Who Would Be King, Hatshepsut's Rise to Power in Ancient Egypt. And she ruled for 15 years, and it was quite a prosperous period for building in Egypt. You discuss the many things. Well, you've already touched on the temples and all the temples that the elites were building, but she left behind some wonderful structures, the Temple of Millions of Years, for one, in Thebes.
The Temple of Millions of Years, yes, at Deir el-Bahri. It's such a beautiful place, a layered structure, stages in succession, if you like, with ramps connecting them. And in front of these grand stages are colossal statues of Hatshepsut as the god of Osiris with crossed arms, a series of them, row upon row. And inside the temple, she's depicted receiving offerings from the gods, giving offerings to the gods, being crowned. The expedition to the mythical land of Punt is in that place. It's one of my favorite temples to visit. And her personal life is also memorialized there, because there she depicts her sister, who we think died very young. She depicts her daughter in large scale, as if she's trying to push her forward politically, and she was ultimately unsuccessful in that endeavor. And I do talk about that in the book. She shows her mother. Her nephew is depicted quite often. So her whole family, all of her intimate relations, are there in that temple. So it's a very personal space as well.
A personal space, but it's one of the few places you can find Hatshepsut when it comes to the hieroglyphics and the like that exist, because not long after her reign ended, all these markings began to be obliterated.
Well, and that temple was so important that they couldn't destroy the structure. It was important ritually and cultically. So they went through with their chisels and removed her images. But the temple was so important that they only removed the very first layers. And so even if you go in there today, even though they chiseled it all down, you can see her names. You can see what's happening in those reliefs. The statues are a different story. And it's interesting, the ferocity that they had when they went after these statues to destroy them. They took these massive sledgehammers and broke apart statues of very hard stone, red granite, granodiorite, quartzite. These stones are hard to craft. They're also hard to destroy. And it seems they struck at the uraeus cobra on her forehead first, attacking her kingship, severing her from her kingship, and then smashed the statues up and threw them into an ignominiously named pit in the ground called the Hatshepsut Hole by archaeologists. I know.
But the I also found it interesting in your book, The Woman Who Would Be King, how depictions of Hatshepsut changed during her reign, where she's very feminine in the beginning, and by the end she is just like the pharaohs that we're used to, with the headgear and the false beard, and much more masculine.
It's extraordinary. This was a woman who knew that she couldn't create a system from scratch, who knew she had to mold herself to the system. So she starts out depicting herself as a young woman with narrow shoulders and a very pert, beautiful, heart-shaped face, very Barbie-like eyes and nose. And as her reign continues, she realizes she has to change herself. And her first change, she shows herself as a young woman with breasts, but without a shirt on. And it's an incongruous statue. And you look, it's a shocking statue when you actually see it, because it seems like she's there naked with her breasts exposed. And she's seated there very peacefully with a serene expression. And then right after she realizes this is unsuccessful, that people looked at it and were probably a little bit shocked. And maybe if she appeared before her people in actuality that way, she may have gotten some of the same looks. I don't know, without my time machine. But but eventually she depicted herself as a man, in reliefs and in stature. And you wonder what she did in ritual processions as well. Did she bind her breasts? Did she show herself in this way? But she's doing it at exactly the moment when her co-king and nephew is becoming a man himself. She knows, having an older woman in the primary place telling a young man whose kingship is rightfully his what to do is problematic. So she molds herself to be able to always one-up him, to always have that power over him.
So there's very little firm evidence and firm material to reconstruct Hatshepsut's life. What did you do to write the book, The Woman Who Would Be King? Because I know you had to take a little bit of liberty from time to time.
I mean, I say quite openly in the book that I break all of the academic rules that I can break.
But you said a wonderful scene. You were talking before about the incense and the rituals going on, and I felt like I was there. So.
Well, you know, my academic work working with coffins and reuse is very detail oriented. I try to be very thorough and data driven, right? This is data driven to some extent. And so I can find a circumstance. I can find a moment where Hatshepsut is on the throne and her nephew is 3 or 4 years old and that certain courtiers around and things are happening. And that's where I inject conjecture. And that's where I apologize to my academic colleagues and say, I understand I'm breaking all of the rules. But if we don't, then we'll always have book after book describing a stone monument, describing a statue, describing something. And I wanted to take it further. I wanted to figure out what her decision-making process was. And the only way I could really do that was by creating the scenes, conjecturing how she may have felt. Did she feel threatened? Did she feel like she could only take incremental steps? Did she feel like this was a moment to take a big leap? And why? And who was around her? And how might she have worked it? When did people push back? And when did she realize that she'd grasped too much? And how does this work? So I took the history that we know, and then I added a liberal amount of detective work, of basic psychology. How do people act when they're threatened? How do people act when they're trying to get something that shouldn't necessarily be theirs, but they want? And that's where I took it. And I write it in a very open fashion. So you'll know when I'm conjecturing and when I know that there's a definite fact at stake.
From your account in the Woman Who Would Be King, it seems like she played a very important role in Egypt, but is just seriously overlooked in this day and age. I mean, forgotten about. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, so let's say we go outside, we go to a bus stop, and we talk to whoever's there, and we say, "Have you heard of Cleopatra?" Oh yes, everybody's heard of Cleopatra. The Jezebel? Yeah, she was a bad woman, whore of Babylon, something or other. You can cut that if you need to. I don't know. But Hatshepsut, do you know about this woman, Hatshepsut? No. No, people can't pronounce her name. It does not roll off the tongue, so it doesn't help. But it's not something that we even hear. And so the more I thought about that, and the more I thought about the Jezebels or the Boudiccas or the Cleopatras, the women who have to kill themselves or are destroyed or use sexuality or glamour or ego, those women we write tales about and we replicate those tales and we tell them again and again, and Shakespeare writes plays and we aggrandize the horrible end of these women who had it coming. But the woman, the one woman, really the one woman from all of antiquity that I've been able to find who did it right, who left Egypt better than she found it, who acted as a mother to her dynasty and saw its legacy and saw it continue. She is the woman that we've forgotten. We don't know her name. She did it so perfectly that the kings who came after were able to take credit for everything that they did, that she did, because they wanted to, and it was easily done. So in a way, this woman's a resource to me, and I want to resurrect those things that she was able to do, and ask the question, why is female success treated with sometimes derision and outright hostility? And let's call a spade a spade. It's not like women are walking through the halls of power taking over the world. It's very hard for women to find a political place in this world.
The Woman Who Would Be King, Hatshepsut's Rise to Power in Ancient Egypt, a book by Kara Cooney, available where books are sold. You can learn more at wvxu.org. And Kara, what are you reading now?
Oh, I have a lot of books going on my Kindle. I don't usually read in paperback because I have a 4-year-old, and I end up reading. I'll put him to sleep. I'll put him to sleep, and then I have the backlit. You know, I can read my Kindle on the low light, and so I do spend a lot of time reading. So I'm reading Wolf Hall by Hilary Mann, which is set in Henry Tudor's England, and that's wonderful. And I'm reading the biography of Catherine the Great by Robert Massey, which is much more detailed and much more academic than my book. My book is much sexier, but Catherine the Great is a lot of fun. And then I picked out this other book by Leslie Steiner called Crazy Love. Do you know it?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
I do.
It's a memoir, right? All about this horribly abusive relationship that she was in, and I find that very interesting.
All about women in power.
I
there,
know.
Right?
I know. Yeah.
Well, thanks for being on the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kara Cooney, the book is The Woman Who Would Be King, Hatshepsut's Rise to Power in Ancient Egypt. This is the Book Club at 91.7.
What is the scariest book you've ever read?
Hey there, my name is Harold Touch. I'm from Amelia. And the scariest book I've ever read would have to be George Orwell's 1984, for fairly obvious reasons.
Hi, my name is Peyton. I am from Cincinnati, but I just recently moved to Jackson, Mississippi. The scariest book that I have ever read is Flood by an author named Stephen Baxter. It is a science fiction account of the end of the world via water rising and covering every landmass on the planet, and how human civilization is slowly almost wiped out over the course of 30 years.
My name is Dave Gilligan. I live in East Walnut Hills. The scariest book I ever read was The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Hi, I'm Erin Back from Bridgetown, and I have to say this was a toss-up between three Stephen King novels. It, because I am terrified of clowns, Pet Sematary makes me never want to visit a cemetery again, and The Shining. I had to choose The Shining. The Shining actually starts off really slow, but once you get into it a little bit more, I couldn't put it down. I was jumpy, paranoid, the whole shamboozle.
The Book Club at 91.7 wants to hear your voice. What is the scariest book you've ever read? You're invited to call the Book Club at 91.7 hotline 352-9188 and leave a voicemail. You'll be prompted for your name, where you're from, and what book scared you the most and why. You may hear your answer on the air. What is the scariest book you've ever read? Call 513-352-9188 and share the shivers.
You You've been listening to the Book Club at 91.7. Technical director is Bruce Ellis. Rick Andrus is music director and segment engineer. Robin Carey Allgaier is the announcer. Jim Nolan is the club's web guru. And Kevin Reynolds is the producer. Kevin, what are you reading?
Actually, I'm reading a book by an author that you did an interview with not too long ago. It's called The Holier the Broken by Alan Light. And it's a story about the song Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. And it's this incredibly complex story about a minor hit song, the number of times Leonard Cohen changed the lyrics, his initial sort of disdain for the song altogether, and then how another artist, Jeff Buckley, took it and really sort of made it his own, although Leonard Cohen is still, I think, will always be affiliated with that song no matter what happens.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening to the Book Club at 91.7. Next Saturday morning, more Halloween fun with America's Most Haunted and Super Boys, the story of the creation of Superman. I hope you'll join me then. And stay tuned for Weekend Edition coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.